What I love just about Campion is when you watch this moment, you see what she wants you to see, and she's evoking in you what she wants to evoke in you.
Yeah.
She's playing us like a piano or something.
I love being played like that.
Listening to the Bright Wall Dark Room podcast, a space where we belly up with critics, artists, and our magazine's contributors to speak from the heart about film. I'm Veronica Fitzpatrick.
And I'm Chad Perman. Happy New Year.
Oh, Happy New Year.
Yeah.
Chad, how are you?
Doing pretty good. How are you?
I'm good. I'm cold.
Weather-wise or just in general?
My heart. No, yeah, weather-wise.
Your heart.
Yeah. Yeah, cold snap. Real winter for the first time. Been spending a lot of time indoors watching movies.
Which is not the worst way to spend time.
No. I suppose it's not. I really want to ask because I know like that you saw Old last night. You want to say a few words about that?
I did. Oh, man. I don't know if I want to spoil our podcast with talking about Old.
Oh.
It didn't work for me. How about I'll keep it at that? I like the concept a lot, and I just didn't like the execution. You know, I love Vicky Creeps so much, and they didn't do a lot with her either. I don't know. I have a hard time being negative about stuff, but it wasn't for me.
Well, speaking of Vicky Creeps, I just watched Bergman Island, which is streaming now.
Oh, yeah. I saw that last week, too.
Yeah. I wonder what you think of it. I fell asleep in the first, like, third.
That's not good.
No, I actually don't think that that's not good. I think that's fine. I think that's a fine way to interact with cinema.
For you or for the movie?
For anybody. I mean, I woke up. I picked it right back up. I loved when it sort of gets to the Mia Wasikowska, like Anders Danielsson Lee movie in a movie type of thing like that. I found really great. But it is very lulling. I mean, all that kind of natural sound and,
yeah,
you know, seascapes.
I don't know if they're actually on an island in Old, but yeah, that was a weird movie pairing that I did this week to see Bergman Island and Old, and both of them have the same kind of main star in it. And
right.
Very, very different movies from two very different directors.
But it's like, are they? Because I feel like Bergman Island is about the beach that makes you old.
Ooh, oh, deep.
You know?
But I'm really excited today because of a couple things. But one is like, this is the first podcast you've been on for us that we're talking about a movie made in this century.
Oh.
So that's really exciting.
We're finally up to date.
We're doing a new release. We did a Green Knight one, but neither of us were on that one.
That's right.
And so this is the first new release one we've done. And we have our first non-Brightwall Darkroom like contributing guest, which is super exciting to start the new year.
I know. Do you want to say a little bit about the month's theme?
Yeah, it's pretty self-explanatory. It's just since we publish essays and set of reviews and essays take a little bit longer to write, we put our best of 2021 issue, or best of any year, we put out in January of that year. So we kind of miss all the bombardment of December best of the year lists and essays and compilations. And we come back when no one cares anymore and say, hey, here's ours. But hopefully have a little bit deeper reflections and thoughts on some of those. So yeah, we have a really full issue, probably one of the biggest we've had in years. And sometimes those issues don't actually encapsulate what the staff personally liked best, but this one is a pretty good one. You know, Licorice Pizza, West Side Story, and Undine, which I really want to see now after reading that essay.
Oh, it's so good.
We just have a ton of stuff. Pretty much anything that you've heard of this year that's on any of the lists we're actually covering, which has happened far less often than you'd think for a film site. Surprisingly, nothing on The Power of the Dog was even submitted, let alone published.
Whoa.
So I was really excited when you were mentioning like, hey, maybe we should do this one. I haven't seen it yet, but I want to see it. And I was like, oh, let's do that one.
I was excited to do our film Power of the Dog, in part because we were thinking about who to have on the pod. Mm-hmm. And I saw that it was on our guest's best of list. And
ooh,
it was like the perfect convergence. So joining us is film critic and author of The New Cinephilia, Girish Shambu. Girish is a real touchstone for those of us who think and write about film on the internet. He's editor of the Film Quarterly blog Quorum. He's run his own eponymous film blog since 2004.
Wow.
So like a real formative figure. And in addition to his day job, where he's professor of management at Canisius College in Buffalo, he also contributes vital, sensitive, and utterly contemporary film writing to forums like Framework, Art Forum, and Film Comment, where I have listened to him guest on podcasts for years. And long before the podcast was a gleam in our shared eyeball, I used to wait for his voice to enter the conversation. And just on a personal level, Girish's voice as a critic and thinker has been formative and informative for me for years. So it's my absolute dream to have him guest on our podcast. Welcome, Girish.
Thank you so much for having me. This is a real blast, a real pleasure. And I really look forward to chatting about Power of the Dog and Jane Campion with you all.
Welcome.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Yay. Girish, do you want to say maybe a little bit about how you brought this movie onto your best of list?
I was fully resigned to watching this film on Netflix. I'd been kind of reading about it before it came out. But then in the midst of COVID, I wasn't expecting to do this, but I was invited to the International Documentary Film Festival in Amsterdam in November, just a couple of months ago.
Oh, wow.
So my partner and I decided to just go, and we've heard that it's a great vegan town. We're big foodies, so we figured we should go eat and drink in Netherlands and watch some documentaries. But when I got there, the first thing I did was pick up the paper and look, or pick up my phone and look to see, is Power the Dog playing anywhere? I know it's not a documentary, not in the festival. Almost felt guilty for seeking it out when I should be doing other things like watching and writing about documentaries. But it was playing, and we went and saw it with almost nobody else in the theater.
Oh,
and
gosh.
It was such a wonderful big screen experience.
That was my number one thought. I just wanted to see it on the big screen so badly.
I know. And I don't think it played very much on the big screen. It certainly didn't play here in Buffalo where I live.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
So you saw it in a mostly empty theater in Amsterdam.
Yeah, at the Rialto, like this old school theater in Amsterdam.
What an experience.
I love the idea of you like cheating on the movies that you're supposed to be seeing.
I know. At some point, everything becomes work, you know, even if you love movies. So
exactly.
Totally. But also seeing a movie in a foreign city that you're on vacation or work trip or whatever in is one of my absolute favorite things to do.
Yeah.
You're right. I try to do the same thing. Seek out movies and escape whatever my commitment might be, even if the commitment is vacation.
Yeah,
exactly.
Well, let me not do what we often do, which is forget to say the synopsis.
Let's go to the end of the movie.
Yeah, exactly, of the film before we start talking about some meticulous detail from the conclusion. So this is Jane Campion's first feature since 2009's Bright Star. Power of the Dog is adapted from Thomas Savage's 1967 novel about two brothers running a ranch in 1925 Montana. It's a study of contrasts. We have George, played by Jesse Plemons, who's kind and soft and moderate and well-dressed. We have Phil, played by Benedict Cumberbatch, who's volatile, hands dirty, a loner. George meets and ends up marrying a widowed single mother, Rose, played by Kirsten Dunst, whose effete son, Peter, attracts the brunt of Phil's hostility, but also his curiosity. And herein lies some of the film's, I think, most defining and fascinating kind of ambivalence with relation to gender and genre and so much else.
Good job.
Thanks.
That was really good. I like that. Say more.
No, I'm good. Chad, why don't you tell us a little about why it's in your list too? Because for a little behind the scenes, like Chad and I were talking on Slack about what to talk about, and there was like a whole paragraph of possible films, and this is the one I zeroed in on your list.
Yeah. You know, it ended up on my list. It was a late entry. I planned my year pretty badly in terms of taking time off as a therapist. So I had this stretch where I didn't take any time off from like June until December 17th. And that's a really long time to go without taking time off. But one thing I did do is make a big, huge list of all these movies. I was like, okay, I haven't watched really a lot of stuff this year from 2021. So I made this huge list and went down through it, and Power of the Dog was near the very end. So I actually got through most of the other things. I had my top 10 pretty locked in. I'm pretty nerdy and obsessive about moving all that stuff around like anybody cares besides me. I was not expecting this one to crack I think it was third. But I think after last night, I might bump it up to second. I just thought it was really, really good a second time, which I can explain later. But I really just was really just taken by it. It's one of those things where, you know, you hit play on this. I'm sure we've all had this experience in the streaming era. You hit play, you're like, okay, let me just watch a few minutes of this to kind of get the ball rolling. I'll come back to it tomorrow when I have more time. It's one of those, you know, kind of cliched, I couldn't turn it off. I was like, what is happening? I am so into whatever ominous awfulness is coming my way. And I need to know what it is before I can turn this off and go to sleep, because this will haunt me in some way until I know what's going on. So I watched the whole thing all the way through, which for me, I mean, again, in 2021, watching a movie from start to finish at home on your couch has got to be a rare thing to do.
With kids.
With kids,
I want to remind our viewers, you have a lot of responsibilities.
Yes, I do have to wait till everyone's gone to bed. Finding 2 hours. I mean, I didn't have the 2 hours, and that's a testament to the film. I made time for the film instead of I lost some sleep for the next day and things like that. But it was so worth it. I was just very captured by every aspect of it.
Girish, I know that you are a big Jane Campion fan. How does this strike you in terms of continuing her career's work?
You know, I was kind of nervous when I first read about this film because the first one to have a focus on a male protagonist, which she'd never done before. And I had precisely enjoyed the previous films because of that, because so much of my kind of movie going and cinephilia for years was, you know, without my realizing it, shaped by auteurism, male auteurs, male cinema. And so when I discovered Jane Campion, it was really something new for me. And so when I heard that she was making a film for the first time with a man and with Benedict Cumberbatch, about whom I have complicated feelings.
Let's put a pin in that and come back.
We will have a whole conversation,
I was just nervous, but then the film just blew me away. I've seen it twice so far, once on the big screen, once on the small screen. And I think there's a lot of continuity in this film with her previous work. And it should not have surprised me, but I'm sure we're going to talk about those things during this podcast.
I was thinking about it too, about the switch to the male perspectives and protagonists, I suppose. And it does feel totally continuous for me with In the Cut and with Top of the Lake China Girl, which I feel like is criminally underseen. Nobody's seen it. It's like hidden in Hulu.
Was that the second one?
It is. Yeah. Top of the Lake China Girl is just one of the craziest media texts about women's vulnerability and the menace of masculinity that I've ever seen. And it is batshit crazy. Like the stuff that goes on specifically in that second season, there's like one set piece in particular involving like an office conference room being set on fire in the midst of an attempted assault. Like, it is just so insane.
Wow.
And I know it's a collaborative effort and everything, but it does feel like she's had this kind of vested interest in exploring the worst consequences and the unpredictable repercussions of men's insecurities, I guess, and the sort of like dangers of that.
What? That's not a thing.
Indeed. Even though this feels really like a departure insofar as it's a Western, it feels kind of like a horror movie to me too. It reminds me of like Ravenous and Deliverance and other things that are similarly set, but there's also continuity and such a unified vision.
I'd heard you talk on a podcast a few years ago about In the Cut, Gresh, and I haven't heard from or talked to anybody who enjoyed that film or probably even saw it. And I do. I loved it. But I mean, you know, before the internet was what the internet is, I had no one to talk to about it when I first saw it 20 some years ago. And so I'm just curious to hear, I mean, you talked a lot about how that movie shifted your or turned your eyes on to Campion in a new way, something like that. I was just wondering, that podcast was a few years ago, if those thoughts have evolved at all, or just kind of taking a really brief detour into In the Cut, because I want to hear a little bit about your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I'm a huge fan of that film, but I remember when I first watched it when it came out, I think it was 2003, and it was actually the first film to be shot in New York after 9/11, and that's kind of a theme in the film. One of my big preoccupations with Campion, which a lot of critics somehow don't seem to resonate with, at least in my knowledge, is I find her films to be very expressionistic and hyperbolic. And many people will say, oh, like I read some reviews of Power of the Dog that said that it was heavy-handed. And I don't actually believe that. And I think it's very intentional when she heightens something or exaggerates something or hyperbolizes something, either in the dialogue or in the audiovisual design or in gesture, and placement of bodies in the frame. I think all that's happening very intentionally and very playfully. And I say this deliberately because this is like a, as Veronica said, it's a kind of a conflation of like a horror and a Western. It's like a gothic Western or something. It's a very serious film. But to me, it had me chuckling all the way through the film based on the stylistic choices that she made that seemed very deliberate. And she was playing with the form and playing with dialogue. So once I kind of realized that within The Cut, because In the Cut, its compositions, its cutting is kind of so exaggerated, so expressionistic that it gives you the feeling of menace, as Veronica mentioned. So male menace in a big city is just all around you in that film. And she enforces that in just these random objects she cuts away to, the lighting, the framing. And so it really kind of showed me what I loved about her cinema, which is that it's both socially and politically provocative and formally and stylistically, it's just doing some really daring, interesting things. And I still believe that about In the Cut.
And I like how you took that fairly random esoteric question and tied it back into Power of the Dog. Because, yeah, male menace in the big city, and then here we got male menace in the big country.
Big country. It is so important, I think, too, to emphasize that it's intentional.
Yeah.
And that it's playful, or it's magnifying in some kind of way, and not that it's just an error mm-hmm. or an instance of like hysterical direction, which I feel like is the kind of sexist charge that
yeah.
something like In the Cut, people act like those ice skating interludes are just a mistake.
Yeah.
Like a hallucination or something.
I don't think she does mistakes. Yeah.
Yeah. It's unthinkable to me.
Yeah.
Obviously, everything is so composed and the result of considered decisions. And I do feel like that has a maybe more sophisticated result or look in The Power of the Dog. But yeah, I mean, not only funny, but like, gosh, really moving,
yeah.
sometimes so beautiful that it's just like you're stuck in this moment of contemplation. I would love to hear what some of, for both of you, your favorite like shots or images are.
Oh man.
In the film, since there's so many like pausable moments.
Yeah,
I would just say yes. It's all my favorite shot. There's so many beautiful, I mean, just even trying to think of listing them, it would break that one perfect shot website. It's beautiful. Just watching it again last night. That's just what I mean, all these other things we're talking about are very important and very interesting to track. And I love talking about all that stuff. But on a just visceral level, having seen so many movies in short succession after not having seen some in a while, some movies are just movies and some movies are movies, you know. And this one was like, it starts and you're like, oh, it's a movie. You just know right away, like you're in such good hands and you have no idea where you're going to go with it. I just love that feeling of knowing like, okay, you know, take me somewhere. I know we're going on a ride here. And I just think right from the start and watching it the second time through, even to see how much of it, there's just no possible way to even pick up on the first time through because you don't know where the plot's ultimately going.
Hmm.
And you're caught up in the emotional response to that. And you're caught up in like, this is all not going to end well. I know, but what's going to happen?
Hmm.
Watching it through the second time without some of that tension that I had the first time because I knew it was going to happen. You can see how everything is perfectly plotted. Like I almost want to cry at how perfect all the little details are slotted in. You're like, yeah, if you want to track it all the way through, here you go. It all works out.
Mm.
Every little thing, the first line of the movie predicts the end of the movie. I mean, and you have no way of knowing that the first time you see it, but you see it the second time, it's like, what a masterstroke. It's right there. So yeah, I was just captured by just the experience of it in a way that I watch a lot of movies and I don't often get that feeling as much as I used to in my younger movie watching days when everything was amazing. And I really just had that feeling again. And it just was like, this is why I like movies, you know, whatever this is. That was my first response. I just was so captured by all the shots and the beauty of it. I loved it.
If I could point to a moment and invoke the kind of a shot that Veronica made fun of a few moments ago, which is like revealing something at the end of the film. Is it okay for me to do that?
Absolutely.
This is the longest we've ever gone without spoiling something so far.
Yeah. Jump around.
Okay. All right. This shot made me laugh. And also like wrenching shot, which is Phil's hand plunging into the water, immersing himself with, and the blood kind of flowing out of it and the hide at the end. And then you realize, oh my God, he's purely poisonous, like literally toxic shot. And to me, that felt classic Campion, like hyperbolizing in like an expressionistic way, something that could have been shown in a much more muted way.
Mm-hmm.
There are so many moments like that. And maybe I can point to one more. At the beginning of the film, the first time we see Peter, we don't actually see him. We see like a super, super tactile close-up of the flowers that he's cutting with scissors.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it's such a striking moment because it's in the shallow focus. It's extremely vivid. And also scissors could be a weapon or it could be like an instrument of craft.
Mm-hmm.
And it connects me to her earlier work, like the credit sequence of Bright Star, the film about Fanny Braun and John Keats is very similar.
Oh, yeah.
In that it's like a needle being threaded and then a needle kind of stabbing a cloth as she's kind of sewing.
Yeah.
And that's the credit sequence. And so again, these domestic items that could be very innocuous, or they could be just dangerous, like a needle or scissors, things like that.
Yeah.
And so a lot of her films have these interest in craft, especially women interested in craft, like Ada in The Piano, you know, she plays the piano, and Franny and in The Cut is a poet.
Mm-hmm.
Janet Frame is a writer, Angel at My Table. And the interesting thing in this film was she moved some of that to the male characters, like Peter is the one interested in craft. And even Phil does the feminized work of like braiding and plaiting when it comes to making the rope.
Phil's a craftsman,
I love that. That's so well observed that she really seems to understand props and the sort of polyvalence of objects. And that so struck me in this movie. I mean, talk about the ending when Peter is like handling the coil of rope with gloves at the end of the film and then slides it under the bed, which incidentally, totally unrelated, but really reminded me of the shots of the slippers under the bed in The Mood for Love.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And how in that moment, there's this kind of like freighting of a really mundane object with all of this crazy significance and ambiguity too, because there's something for me really, and this is not just in this moment, but throughout the film, erotic, tactile and sensual, and has like a bit almost of longing in it. And nothing as narrative as like regret, but I don't know, some kind of tense admixture of feelings. And I really admire that this film refuses to reconcile any of it and just sort of proposes it and makes it look really, really beautiful and lets that dread kind of percolate and doesn't try to pursue resolution in any kind of way.
Yeah. I mean, I can't believe we've gone this far without saying Johnny Greenwood out loud, because I know to Veronica, I was like, I just can't stop listening to this score. He's my favorite film composer on earth, but I don't think anything's ever going to push the Phantom Thread score off of my music to write to list. And I think I'd write some pretty creepy essays if I had Power of the Dog playing the whole time. But this is right up. I mean, this is like master level. And I hit mute a couple times last night just to see how the scenes would play out without the music. And it's the narrative changes dramatically. I mean, she has some ominous shots, but for the most part, the music's carrying a lot of that heavy load in some of the quieter parts, which is not to diminish Campion at all, because she purposely sought out Johnny Greenwood and worked with him really closely on the score and what she wanted. So it's still part of her vision, but it's just amazing how much work that music is doing throughout that movie in some of the same kind of ways as Campion, where it's, you can tell that Johnny Greenwood knows what he's doing and knows how to write a film score, but you can also tell that he's going to mess with it a little bit, the same way that, you know, Campion often does in her movies. Kind of that idea of like Picasso could paint a perfect picture if he wanted to that looks very realistic. You kind of got to master the craft before you move on to the more wide-ranging stuff. I think they're artists very well suited to each other. I just never thought before a few months ago of a universe in which Jane Campion and Johnny Greenwood's art comes together. This is just amazing, a confluence of talents there. And I lost the original question that I'm answering, so I'm just gonna stop.
Well, I think it's really interesting how there's so much slippage in the film between the music feeling diegetic and non-diegetic. Obviously, music is really important in the diegesis, in terms of Phil is constantly playing, he's plucking the banjo. He's weirdly virtuosic at the banjo.
Oh, God, the banjo.
From the very beginning. And then poor Rose used to play piano for cinemas and has this kind of plink plonk, like, I don't know. I don't play any instruments.
It is one of the worst pieces of like music to play, on top of the fact that she can't play it very well.
Yeah, I don't want to have any judgments, but it doesn't sound so great. And then the way that Phil specifically sort of intimidates her and undermines her and drives her to like fatal drinking, it's on the level of sound, right? It's like him unseen somewhere in the house starting to produce like the correct, actually very advanced version of the song that she's like struggling to eke out.
The top of his head.
Yeah.
Bullying through music. I've never seen that.
I know. Think. And there are moments too, like when she runs out to sell the hides when she's drunk.
Oh, the piano. Yeah.
Yeah. And the piano in the score in that moment feels
goes crazy.
Really jangly and scary, and also redolent of when she's trying to play the piano and kind of failing at it.
Yeah. And then there's just moments of very classic score with string stuff too. That shouldn't work, all of that together, and it works so well. And speaking of sound, the fingers on the comb moment, oh my goodness.
Oh, yeah.
Oh my God, yeah.
Yeah.
I'm getting the little goosebumps as I'm talking about it, of like that sound.
I know, it sucks.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What a moment.
It's great. The comb also is an addition to all these domestic objects that could also be threatening in a way, like the needle and Bright Star.
Yeah, and the scissors you're talking about.
The scissors, and also like the way he dies with the hide, strips of hide, which are actually a very innocuous object, but they kind of bring him to his death. So there's something like Hitchcockian or something about that. Ordinary things becoming threatening.
Yeah.
There's also an echo with his whistling
when
she's in the alley. That's such a creepy sound that he makes from the window.
Oh, God, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, everything about him is, you know, I watched it twice, but it was only in reading this morning about it that I put this together, that he never actually does a lot of actually confrontational or violent stuff. It is all just the implied threat of who he is and how everyone's freaked out by him. It's always the implication of what could happen, the menace, as Gersh was saying earlier, but in the cut. Mm-hmm. It's just amazing how well she established, and I'm sure Benedict Cumberbatch is part of that as well, mm-hmm. to get back to him. But just how she establishes just this awful just menace that just runs throughout that whole thing, that first viewing, I mean, that just dominated my whole experience of it, mm-hmm. as I'm sure it did for the characters in the house. You hear that banjo 3/4 of the way through the movie and you just freak out, mm-hmm. which is masterful to be able to put those two things together, where even just like, where is he in the house? I hear the banjo, like, this is not good. Mm-hmm. You know? I'm just in awe of how well these pieces fit together, which I guess I just keep finding new ways to say.
I think it is really amazing how, this seems obvious to say, but how cinematically she sort of solves that problem of depicting what kind of villain Phil is.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking of, for me, one of the really indelible images of the film is when he's scrutinizing the paper flowers at the restaurant inn where she and her son are housed and working in the beginning of the film before she marries George, Phil's brother. It's this close-up of his like dirty thumbnail,
yeah.
fingering the flower in this way that is obviously like genital, like uncomfortable, like an image of violation and like foreshadowing of the stuff we find out about Phil's sexuality further into the film. It's so economical and like great to look at the same time.
Tactile. Too, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the things that really struck me was how much she really just trusts that, hey, if you're watching this, I trust you as the viewer to put all these pieces together. I'm not going to give you all these exposition. When you actually watch how many scenes are not in there that would be in a more typical movie like this, where they're explaining,
mm-hmm.
which I just happened to hear Kirsten Dunst on Fresh Air earlier this week. And she said they shot a ton of scenes, all these scenes that you would expect to be in there.
Mm-hmm.
There's a scene where she's drunk and she's asking Phil why he doesn't like her more. She said, like, I was really mad that scene wasn't in there, but then you realize when you see the film, like how those over-explanatory, like obvious scenes just suck all the air out of the tension. Mm-hmm. And so then I really noticed that, you know, watching it through last night, is like the brothers do mention the fact that, like, hey, you're kind of treating her son bad, you know, but even those scenes are so clipped and short, and she just doesn't do any of the obvious stuff. And to hear that there's actually reams and hours of footage that she cut down into this very economical, tight 2-hour package.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't find a scene last night at my second viewing that I'd been like, oh, that doesn't need to be there. Like, mm-hmm. every single piece just locks in so tightly. And you just think about the artistry inherent in being able to put this kind of a puzzle together and have it all click in to like a fairly like thriller-ish mm-hmm. type of ending after this really meandering kind of open-ended artistic Western thing. And then it just has this tight as hell ending that just locks it all down and doesn't end in ambiguity, which I just thought for sure that I was going to get an ambiguous ending on this movie. So,
well, I want to come back to the idea of whether or not and how the ending is or isn't ambiguous, because I feel like there is ambiguity in that ending.
Oof. Okay, let's come back to that.
But it's really interesting to me hearing what you're saying, Chad, about the economy of the plotting and the edit, that one of the scenes that I've seen sort of cited on Twitter quite a bit in people talking about how great the film is, or just sort of highlighting one perfect shot style, like a moment that really sticks out in mind,
mm-hmm.
is when George and Rose are married and they have a picnic type of situation up on some kind of
mm-hmm.
mountain or something. I don't know. And
Montana.
Yeah, in Montana, New Zealand for Montana. And they have this really tender moment where they sort of mutually acknowledge how wonderful it is to be together. And then Rose teaches George how to dance, or it's the opposite, actually. She teaches him how to dance and then they have the moment. But that's not in the novel, which I haven't read, but have like heard in interviews as an addition. And I'm always interested in like how a filmmaker adds something to a film adaptation that's not in the source material, but seems to somehow be really in the spirit of the source material and bring something uniquely cinematic or visual or oral or whatever to the text.
Yeah.
That scene. And maybe it's because Jesse Plemons and Kirsten Dunst are married in real life. There's just something really almost unbearably tender about his saying how great it is that they don't have to be alone.
That was my favorite line in the movie, even that has not a lot to do with the plot. Of those two characters, she said the thing that drew them together, at least according to her take on, and this is Kirsten Dunst, was the loneliness. And she said the loneliness and the kindness of the two characters, and how they recognized a mutual kind of tenderhearted like kindness to the way they approach life, and then also just the deep loneliness and how back then that's all you really needed to get married. You know, just like, okay, let's just be a little bit less lonely together.
I think that's now too, probably.
Yeah, I mean, that's always probably. It feels a lot more complicated now. But yeah.
Well, there's definitely more people. It feels like there's no other people in the movie, you know? Like, that's like, well, you're a woman, we're sort of the same age. Like, should we just do this together? Like, there's something sort of inevitable feeling about it. Girish, I would love to hear your thoughts about Benedict Cumberbatch.
I'm not sure if I have any deep thoughts, just gut ambivalence, sometimes dislike. He appears to me full of himself, arrogant. And what really kind of pissed me off at the end of the film, we're used to now seeing this obligatory no animals were harmed in the making of this film.
Oh, right. Yeah.
And that's very prominently not in this film.
Right.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
It's my one kind of point of reservation about the film.
Yeah.
I was raised vegetarian. I don't eat animals. Have not done in a very long time, which was a brief period of experimenting that I now regret.
Your Rumspringa of meat eating.
Exactly.
I've been a vegetarian for 20 years this month, so I'm on board.
Oh, that's great. But then I heard an interview with him where he bragged about going to this boot camp where he learned how to be a cowboy, but then part of it was actually castrating bull calves, you know, with his own bare hands. And,
oh my God.
And apparently he did that in the film as well. And I'm thinking, in this day and age, do you actually really need to do that on your own?
Mm.
He was so proud to be all method about it.
Yeah. Mm.
Kirsten Dunst was forbidden from speaking to him, you know, during the shoot, apparently, and he was very rigorous about this.
Mm.
On the one hand, I admire that kind of dedication. But on the other hand, do you have to be like an ass about it? Like actually, you know, harming animals who've done nothing to you? So that was my one kind of point of irritation against Cumberbatch here.
And we were talking earlier about how we don't see Phil act violently toward Rose and Peter exactly, but there's so much weird violence against animals.
Like when he just starts beating that horse when he's mad, yeah.
Yeah, and calls the horse a little bitch, which is the phrase that he uses on Peter when he realizes Peter was like, sees him, I don't know about spying, but like observes him bathing in like the creek. Animals' treatment of manipulation of violence. It feels like part of what's stitching Phil and Peter together in this weird way.
But the really interesting like connective tissue there is how many interviews I've been reading last week where a lot of what Campion's kind of essence of her, she basically is always looking for the animalistic kind of parts of us to just show we are animals, you know?
Mm.
And she talks about the wildness inherent in animals and how, you know, some of the ways that humans try to cover that up.
Mm.
And if you look through some of her films and you look at even, I mean, she even takes to like Portrait of a Lady, she's just like, there's all these different ways that we have to fit into certain cultural boxes, but that we are at base animals that do these crazy wild animal-based things. Mm. And then we have to try to fit those into and explain later and all that kind of stuff. So when you think about then about when he's being violent to animals and how she equates humans as animals, it's almost like a, I don't know what the word is there. It's an interesting connection because she talks a lot about animals in her interviews. Mm-hmm. And humans as animals. So
there's a weird moment that I'd like to ask you about that I don't really understand in the film. Maybe it can be interpreted in one or more ways. So right after the scene at the end, the great scene with Peter and Phil and, you know, his hand in the water and getting poisoned and so on, when that scene ends and before the scene starts where he doesn't come down for breakfast and people don't know where he is, in between, there's like a few shots that only last a few seconds of horses running around in the barn and then a close-up of a fly on one of the horses. And the horse just kind of shakes off the fly.
Hmm.
It seems like, what is this very brief succession of shots even doing here? I was reminded of how Campion sees us all as animals.
Yeah.
And I was wondering what that meant. I'm not exactly sure how to read that, but it was a very enigmatic interlude between the two scenes.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe she didn't want to go directly from one potent scene into another potent scene.
Mm-hmm.
And it was kind of like one of these pillow sequences in the films of Ozu, like these interstitial shots or sequences.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure if you remember that interlude.
I do from last night. Veronica, what about you?
I do remember. I just rewatched the film this morning for the second time.
Oh, wow. Even more recently.
I don't know what to make. I feel like my instinct would be to say, whether it's intended or not, that one of the effects of that is precisely what you're saying, Garish, about the pillow shots, which is just to build some time in for anxiety. Like, what's happened to Phil? Why isn't Phil down for breakfast?
Yeah.
Just his absence. But thinking about the very beginning of the film, we have, as Chad, you were saying before, this kind of like informative voiceover at the beginning of the film in Peter's voice about what kind of man would he be, which is seems to be one of the film's sort of central inquiries, right? What kind of man are you and how do we know?
Yeah.
But then there's also immediately this shot of the cows. We're on a podcast and I'm making hand gestures, but
are those cows your hands?
Yeah. These are my cow hands. They're like in some kind of like head deadlock, you know, and with their eyes like rolling around. And it's just this image, obviously, of confrontation.
Yeah.
that feels really important and not just like you're on the ranch, but is actually about like tension and foreshadowing and just like an image of people coming up against each other in a way.
She's probably smarter than we are and probably threaded animalistic shots in there to kind of enhance some of that idea of like, yeah, and here's the human animals and here's the, you know.
It strikes me too, thinking about Phil and the horses, if there's a connection and like what it is, that it's so weird to me when he's beating that horse and says something like, your big ugly head. Mm. No one thinks horses are ugly. Like,
no,
horses
exactly.
are widely regarded as the most elegant.
That's a hot take.
You know what I mean? Beautiful animal. So it's just
majestic, yeah.
And obviously with Bronco Henry, we haven't talked about, who is this like unseen figure from the past who supposedly taught Phil and George how to be ranchers. And so is responsible for their livelihood, but also clearly had some kind of sexual mentorship, partnership, relationship with Phil when he was whatever age Peter is supposed to be in the film. I don't know. He's in school, but seems like a teen of some kind. The saddle, that's a big sort of erotic fixture and prop in the film. There's clearly a lot of stuff going on that, curious, your question made me think about with Phil and the horses.
And I was also thinking that there's this wonderful moment when Rose and George are having sex for the first time mm-hmm. in their room. And Phil is really angry and he walks out in the night into the barn. And then he really starts to like polish the saddle
yeah.
and the saddle being kind of like a second skin to the horse, you know? And so again, a connection to animality, but also like Veronica was saying earlier, it's a moment charged with complexity too. Like there's clearly anger there, jealousy,
yeah.
but there's also a kind of longing because that's the first time we see the altar to Bronco Henry.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of a complicated moment. But what I love just about Campion is when you watch this moment, it kind of crystallizes all those things in front of you.
Mm-hmm.
It's not kind of a muddy, sloppy moment. You see what she wants you to see yeah. and she's evoking in you what she wants to evoke in you. And it's almost like a master, like she's playing us like a piano or something.
Yeah.
yeah.
You can just tell this is not this person's first film. It's like a world-class filmmaker working at the peak of her powers. And she can just make us look this way or that, listen to this sound mm-hmm. or that sound and make us think X, Y, or Z.
I love being played like that.
And I was also moved to tears. I also watched the film, like Veronica, overnight, last night and this morning. I just welled up with tears. I'm like, this is beautiful. It's like this beautiful use of this mm-hmm. art form and medium. And I'm also struck by how she is so humble. You know, her latest plans were to like, not really make a film now and just start a pop-up film school because there's so much inequality in the world and people can't go to film school. She's like, yeah, I'm just going to do a free film school. And that's my plan for the next few years. I just love how she's like a human in the world
yeah.
and not just a person who's ambitious in a very like male directed mm-hmm. way where she's like, I'm going to make 10 films in the next 10 years. She doesn't really care about that. I admire the heck out of that.
I do too. I had that same thought when I was watching the conversation she has with Sofia Coppola that I think was shot at New York Film Festival. And it is exactly what you just said. It's not unambitious, but it's just not ambition as the sort of primary directive for art making. That's so beautiful. And then to see that the result is the opposite of amateurish,
yeah.
so meticulous. I mean, I love this work that she did with Ari Wagner, the shot of Peter like hula hooping in twilight. I mean, wow, like yeah. it just completely blew my mind, some of those compositions. And you're right, when she wants us to look at something, it is crystalline and not at all muddy, as you said, but also not didactic. It's not trying to teach us a lesson. The thing in the film that compels me the most is the way it doesn't hesitate to show that there's something possibly redeemable in Phil.
Mm-hmm.
And it's too late. By the time we see it, Peter's plan is already in action. He's already decided he's going to save his mother from her alcoholism based on domestic trouble by killing her brother-in-law. But in that barn scene that Girish, you were just talking about, where there's like this sharing of the cigarette and just all of their interactions, there's so much tension and ambiguity. And I've talked to different people where there are questions of like, is there a mutual flirtation
mm-hmm.
that we're seeing on screen? Is there at least some kind of queer affinity happening between them? Is it strictly a case of like Phil reproducing a potentially power imbalanced situation that he lived through and is now romanticizing with Bronco Henry? What is going on? I love the openness of it.
And it's all there. It could be any of those things.
Yeah.
It's, and it's all those she doesn't close the door on any of those possibilities.
Which, totally.
If that's what you were going with, is there an ambiguity to the ending? I guess, yeah, there is there. Because even the second time through, I'm still not sure of what is real with Phil and what is not. And whether he's even helping the kid out of affinity and I see some of you and me, or if he's doing it to like mess with it. I mean, I just feel like most other screenwriters and directors would have just really made that clear so that you didn't have to do a lot of work as the audience.
Yes.
I do love about Jane Campion and a lot of, you know, to be fair, a lot of non American directors in general, is they leave a lot of that open to interpretation. They're not going to spoon feed you. Here is the dynamics at play and here is how you need to understand them, which is just such a much more interesting way to engage with art, to just let your own brain fill in however it wants to fill in what could be happening here, and to kind of even go back and forth. I feel like I can make an argument both ways equally effectively about what's actually happening in some of those scenes at the end.
Yeah. Another thing that I'm always struck by Campion is even small movements or decisions feel really like monumental to me. Like there's this fantastic enigmatic camera movement where you follow Peter as he's walking past almost like a gauntlet of all of those cowhands who call him a sissy and a Nancy and so on. And then the camera stops at one point and he looks up. And the camera then pans to this nest with four birds in it. And it's like a bird family. They're like tweeting. And then she quickly moves the camera back to Peter, who then walks back. And I'm thinking, what is that about?
Yeah.
Like beautifully orchestrated camera movement, clearly something she thought was important to draw attention to. And yet, Veronica, like you were saying, it's a very open moment. I can bring, you know, various things to bear on that moment as a viewer, but I don't definitively know what was in her mind at that time, what she meant it to signify.
Yeah, that's a great observation. The camera movement is fascinating to me throughout the film. There's a moment when Phil is about to discover the flowers on the table when he first sort of is at that inn type of space. The camera tilts down to signal his attention, right? It's his attention that seems to be motivating the vertical camera movement down to the flowers. And in that moment, it feels like the camera movement is yoked to Phil's perspective and his sort of attention. And it's scary because you don't want the attention of someone like Phil to like light on you, you know?
Yeah.
And you don't want to be thought gay by Phil, basically, which is like what's happening in that moment. Like, oh, don't look at these beautiful flowers and then have a bad thought and tell all your friends. But then later, as you're saying, like it seems liberated from that relationship. That scene is so weird because it feels like Peter is ignoring Phil, but in this way that to me feels resonant with, like, if not authentic flirtation, then sort of perform it like look at me not looking at you type of thing.
Yeah.
He's seducing him. I mean, he has to seduce him in order to get that intimacy that's going to afford him access for what he wants to do. But yeah, it's just like wearing an outfit and walking by and pretending you don't know that someone's looking at you. And in that moment, he does sort of command his attention. And they do have this weird kind of an interaction that seems to be marked by like deference on Peter's part that seems totally performative to me.
Yeah.
Yes. And it almost like pushes reset on their relationship because he says something like, let's start again or something like that. He says to Peter. And I'm also struck by like this beautiful like variety of masculinities that she presents, the like three male characters, Phil being vicious, cruel, intimidating, a bully, and yet learned, went to Yale for classics.
I was going to say, we don't even talk about, like,
I know.
I always forget.
That's fascinating.
And I love how that's left unknown. And, you know, you're not exactly sure what happened to him at Yale.
Yeah.
And how and why did he restart the way he did when he came back? And Bronco Henry surely got to be part of that story in some way.
Yeah.
So that's one kind of masculine. And then you have George, who sometimes I almost wanted to yell at him to stand up for himself or, to, you know, to say something like, you're being cruel, Phil, or something like that. But that's not who he is.
As he's being called fatso every other line by his brother. Like, that's just what he calls him. It's just awful.
I know.
Oh.
So that's one. And then Peter, who's like so fascinating because he's very self-possessed, self-possessed, bold, and yet mysterious. And at one point he goes, my dad always thought I wasn't kind enough.
Yeah.
I'm like, uh-oh.
Yeah.
You know, what is that signal, you know?
Yeah.
So again, Peter has this complex set of characteristics that's so distinct from the other two male characters. So I just find this ensemble of three characters, the qualities to be divided between them in such an interesting way.
Absolutely. I have loved reading various interviews with the costume designer of the film who talks about coming up with this stark minimalist design for how Peter's going to look, and his these like white, I don't know if they're Keds, but like totally impractical.
His kicks. Yeah.
Yeah. His white kicks. Yeah. Dope white kicks. You know, how ill-fitting and like boxy his clothes are and how it just emphasizes his comportment. What's interesting to me about it is that the character, even though he's being described and sort of ridiculed as effeminate, is totally comfortable, obviously, yeah, like Girish, you were saying, with his presentation. And there's something just as unnerving in that as in Phil's kind of hyper-masculine, filthy, unwashed presentation. And I think there's a kind of like game-recognized game between them, especially toward the end when they're spending more time alone together. And Phil is seeing that Peter doesn't have any fear, basically.
That rabbit.
The rabbit, yeah. The snapping of the rabbit's neck, the way he talks about cutting his father down. Though, you know, the ambiguity I was teasing about the end that I'm not sure is there or how it's there or to what effect is actually about Peter as the character, because I saw in the panel discussion at New York Film Festival that Kirsten Dunst was like, yeah, we all had like little secrets about our characters. Mm-hmm. They're not in the screenplay. And this was part of creating a climate of not only intimacy between our characters, but also mystery amid our characters. She's like, yeah, Cody had the secret that he killed his father.
I was going to bring that up and I thought I would sound like a crazy person. Really? She said that?
Yeah, she said that.
Because that's what I wondered last night watching it, was like, wait, did this guy kill his father too to save his mom?
I was fucking shook because I have heard that theory and I dismissed it outright. I was like, no, I don't think so. It doesn't need to be that pat that he's like a little murderer.
Yeah, that does kind of suck the air out of it too.
I still feel like it doesn't have to be that way. Even if the actors had a feeling about how the characters are portrayed, I don't think that that means that the text of the film necessarily has that in it. But I wonder what both of you think about it, because it's interesting to think about if the film is offering us up a sort of double, I don't know, antagonist or villain or or suggesting something about like generational violence or vengeance or whatever.
I don't know. What do you think, Girish?
I would say this struck me more as maybe it could also be seen as an element of process rather than an element of text. Mm. Mm-hmm. So like sometimes I've heard of like method actors when they, you know, create their performances, they outfit their backstories with certain anecdotes or tangentially motivating incidents that don't actually show up in the text of the film itself, mm-hmm, but they're somehow supposed to enhance or inflect their performance. So it kind of helps them give a better performance by knowing certain things that nobody else will know, mm, that won't actually find their way into the story. So to me, that could also have been a function.
Yeah.
But I don't know. It's a fascinating question.
I'm just fascinated by the way Jane Campion works, which I hadn't really looked into that much on set. And I'd be curious to know the breakdown. It's hard to tell from the interviews between what she says and what Benedict Cumberbatch says. It sounds like she was fully on board with wanting him to be method, mm-hmm, and that they kind of co-created this thing. But one of the things we put on her Twitter last night was she had Benedict Cumberbatch write letters to Bronco Henry. And then she had Benedict Cumberbatch as Bronco Henry write the letters back to Phil. And she had like Phil and, you know, his brother dance together so that they would know what their bodies felt like together, because brothers growing up together would know that. So she is all like fully on board with creating this, like, I want this to be as real as we can make it. Mm. And I don't care if we call that method. I don't care if we call that just organic, whatever. She had them hang out for a couple of weeks and just basically be in rooms together without saying anything, but be in rooms as their characters, whatever that means. I'm not an actor. But instead of, you know, Kirsten Dunst, she's sitting in the room as Rose with Cody, but she's not, they're not saying anything. She's like, I just want you to experience being in rooms with these people. So I think the amount of work that she's doing for what I'm sure the casual viewer is just like, this just feels very real, but they have no idea the enormity of effort and work and all these different artists putting all this different backstories. So possibly he killed his father too, but I don't think, probably my guess is that that matters one way or the other to Campion. I think she just wants to float that out there. And I think that she puts a lot of little maybes, like I love how Gresh said that. Maybe. I think there's a lot of maybes in this movie. And I think to have a lot of maybes in a movie, but to also have it feel so perfectly plotted, I just have a hard time thinking of many movies where I get that dual feeling of like, this could go anywhere. And also, this was always on a very specific track.
I think that point about it being relevant in terms of process and not in terms of text is so well put. And I'm going to be thinking about that for a long time, because it really is such an important intervention into a lot of like film Twitter discourse, which is always rife with people like discovering behind the scenes stuff and then using that as a decoder ring for understanding what's going on on screen, which makes me crazy.
Me too.
Because it is so like oblivious to what's actually happening and what we see and hear in the film, which as we've been talking about is so rich and not easily explained and is, if anything, like resisting explanation and being evocative instead. So that's really helpful.
And I do feel like even if you can't explain it, you just get it, which is a really weird space for me to be in as someone who likes to process everything out loud. I think when we listen back to this, if you're a re-listener to your own podcast, I'm just gonna be like, man, I was just struggling to say the same thing over and over again with like, this is perfect and I can't quite say why, I just feel it. And I think a lot of that is the comments both of you guys are making about all of the things that she's doing, plus those maybes, which is the thing I'm going to be thinking about for a while. The maybes of the movie.
Girish, I want to make sure that we get to everything you want to say about the film.
I feel like he's got so many thoughts.
I know.
That we have not accessed yet.
Yeah.
This is a random detail, but I love how Phil says the panano instead of the piano.
Yeah, he does it a couple times, doesn't he?
I know. And that's a kind of studied, non-educated, because he's clear from Yale classics, he knows how to say piano. And yet he deliberately doesn't do that. So this time around watching the film, I was just really thinking about what he must have been like at Yale, and a prequel to Power of the Dog would be like,
oh my God,
Phil Burbank, the Yale years. What would that look like? You know,
it does feel like such an ominous detail when it comes out that he studied classics at Yale. Like, you know, it's so scary. And we know that he's already sort of made a comment to George about how, what was it, he couldn't get into school or couldn't finish school or something. He makes a comment about his lack of intelligence. And it really does feel, as the film goes on, that Peter, who wants to be a doctor like his father, and Phil have this kind of like alienating shared intelligence level that Rose and George, but George doesn't care, he's not paying attention to what's happening, but Rose specifically feels excluded by and threatened by. And it almost seems like she's threatened not only by the risk she feels Phil must pose to her son, even though that's not really borne out in any way. And he seems to be mentoring him instead from the outside, but that there's something shared between them that could steer Peter wrong, and that that steering is somehow like about education or erudition is like so scary to me.
That's great. That's a great point.
Yeah.
I love the panana. I mean, he also says the flowers are purdy. Like he does, he's putting on this like weird set of dialects or something.
When you put all those pieces together, like, you know, he's an artist, right? And he's someone who's clearly struggling with his own masculinity or sexuality. But you think of what that would have meant back then, and he's how he's burying all of that stuff.
Literally.
And of course, you know, psychologically, it's not a huge, you know, you don't have to be a therapist to point out some of the negative sides of repressing all that things about yourself and how that makes you turn on other people. You know, that hurt people idea.
Yeah.
He's clearly so intelligent, but yeah, it's not like Fatso is a stinging, you know, verbal rebuke, but he uses it as like a weapon. He uses all of this language, like from the lisping that he's making fun of to the, you know, to the pit, I don't even know how to say the word, pananio, however he says piano. It just feels like he's ready to just attack. In my own psyche, I'd rather have someone walk up and, you know, punch me in the stomach than to just come up and insult me. It's so much more scary to me to think that someone who's intellectually superior to me could just cut me down at any moment and I have to be in a room with them. There's also that energy too of like, I don't even know how to explain how he does it. It's just menace. I mean, to use that word, it's just so discomforting the whole time that he's on screen, but also kind of charming and seductive. And like, what's he going to do? Like there's a draw and an allure. It's so complex, so complicated.
And also, like, once again, Campion, like, bringing this, like, heightened sense of formal play to exaggerate this. Like, there's this fantastic moment when he sees the mountain for the first time and he shows the cowhands the mountain. And they're asking, what do you see there, you know? At that moment, he doesn't say anything. But it's fascinating in that scene, the way she shoots it. He's the tallest. Phil always walks really erect. And that seemed like a really interesting choice that she made for her. Every time you see him walking, he's like absolutely rock steady, erect. And so he's looking at the mountain. The cowhands around him are all shorter than he is. And the camera angle is a little bit higher than Phil, so that they're all next to him, but below him. And when they talk to him, there's almost like this exaggerated deference that they show towards him, because he's like the Uber man, you know? Like, what do you see there, Phil? Like, you know?
And he never says either.
I know, he doesn't. And yet the way she depicts that encounter says so much about the kind of masculinity that she wants to show in Phil. Yeah. So I just love how there's the character Phil, and then there's the way that Campion brings like the resources of cinema to bear upon like how to depict him from one moment to the next, one shot to the next. Mm-hmm. The film's genius is there.
And the resonance too of then... when the kid picks up what's there right away, and that's probably the most I laughed at the whole movie. He's like, "You got that right away?"
I know.
He's like, yeah, I see what that is. He's like, "You knew that?" This is when I finally picked up that the dynamic is switching and actually he has more power than Phil in it.
Mm. There's a way in which that scene too, the second one, when Peter identifies the barking dog in the landscape, feels doubled not only with that earlier cowhand scene that Girish, you were just describing, right? Like he's like, no, I see it right away. And we have a similar perspective and we get to see Phil's incredulity that Peter has picked it up. But that also feels really doubled to me with that earlier scene between George and Rose and the sense of how nice it is not to be alone. Mm-hmm. Because Phil, earlier in that scene, he says, Bronco Henry taught me to see things that others can't or to see ways that others can't.
Yeah.
And so there does seem to be this kind of investment in exceptionalism and singularity, but also in Phil, and this is sort of in some ways one of the like parts of the movie to me, this wish also to not be alone. Mm-hmm. And so that perception of Peter's perception being the same as his feels like a glimpse of the possibility of not being alone, even in this thing that's given him a lot of pride over the years. Like maybe in lieu of Bronco Henry, there could be companionship or community for him again. And of course, to see that and then have it wrested away by the ending of the film is like much more satisfying and complicated than revenge.
Yeah,
that's a wonderful point. Wonderful point. It's exactly right. It's almost like this capital R romantic idea of there's only a few geniuses, there's only a few seers, like visionaries who can literally see things that others can't. And then there's a certain loneliness about that.
Mm-hmm.
This lone genius idea itself kind of captures that. Mm-hmm. And then, like you just said, Veronica, the fact that he found somebody else who shares the state, the status, you know, is very moving for him.
Mm-hmm.
And he sees Rose and George and the cowhands and most other people to be like below him.
Yes.
Yeah.
Even people like the governor and his wife, he doesn't want to come out and see them. He doesn't really see them as equals.
Mm-hmm.
I think you're absolutely right. That's a great point.
Yeah.
It's going to make me see the film differently.
Great.
I know. Sorry to put that huge weight on the observation you made, but that was brilliant.
Veronica had said something that you said was going to make, that she was going to think about for a long
time. So, yeah, this conversation has, I was already anticipating that it would make me want to watch the movie immediately again.
Yeah, I kind of want to watch it again.
You know, it's definitely how I feel. So
me too.
We should get
me
sponsored
too.
By Netflix. You know?
Yeah.
Hook us up. All right, last call. So every episode we end with a wrap-up segment where we ask our guests, in this case, Girish, for the last thing you watched recently, you know, not Power of the Dog, and then a quick staff recommendation of something that you want to put out there for other people to consume. So what is something that you watched recently?
Something I watched recently. Okay, I would name this really fun thriller from the 90s called The Last Seduction from 1994 with Linda Fiorentino.
Yeah.
I'm a huge fan, and I know Veronica is too, of these thrillers that were made in the late 80s and the early 90s, like erotic thrillers, home invasion thrillers, like Sleeping with the Enemy or Pacific Heights, The Hand That Rocks the Cradle, Stepfather, Bad Influence, Poison Ivy. I just love all these films. They're incredible. I've seen them multiple times. But Linda Fiorentino plays a kind of a femme fatale with a deep and raspy voice who takes almost $1 million from her drug dealer husband, played by Bill Pullman, and she moves to the sticks, which turns out to be right outside of Buffalo. And the few times that a Buffalo is referred to and a character goes to Buffalo, it's like a dark den of sin, which shamefully is associated in the film with transness.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a trans woman who lives in Buffalo. And that itself signals the fact that it's a very dark place.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that representations of transness have changed a lot in the last 20 years, but it kind of reminds us, you know, how much more there is to go in the way that transness is kind of demonized in this film. But apart from that, it's a really fun film. And I love the fact that Linda Fiorentino plays a character who wants sex, no strings attached, and the men around her are upset that she doesn't want romance. It's a blast of a film, and if you haven't seen it, I really recommend it.
Was that your first time seeing it, or was that a rewatch?
It was a rewatch since I saw it in the movies.
Oh,
amazing.
So like a 30-year ago, yeah.
Back in the 90s, yeah, right.
Yeah, yeah.
So more than 20 years ago.
Amazing. I love that movie. I hate that she orders a Manhattan in a dive bar. I feel like that is absolutely an unforgivable faux pas, but you're so right. The like crazy, I mean, she has men falling in love with her left and right. And she's just like, nope, I'm here for a good time, not a long time. Okay. And then a staff recommendation.
Okay. Staff recommendation. Maybe I could recommend one of my all-time favorite movies.
Please.
Since I have the podium here.
Yes.
Yes.
A great indie film from the early 80s, before the indie movement kind of took off with Sex, Lies, and Videotape in the late 80s. Born in Flames by Lizzie Borden.
Oh, yeah.
Not her real name. She changed her name to match that of the axe murderer. And it's this wonderful film about female rebellion. It's set in a New York City of the future. It's like a punk sci-fi film, dystopian New York City, where there's an underground women's army that gets together and protects women from sexual assault. There's a huge black lesbian presence in this film. And it's truly like an intersectional film before we use that word. And it's set 20 years after the socialist revolution, but that still looks like Reagan's America. So that's a deeply ironic film.
Mm.
And there's great cameos by people like Catherine Bigelow and other people. It's shot like guerrilla style documentary for $40,000, but it moves like a thriller. It has great music and it's a fun time.
Oh, fabulous.
Amazing.
Yeah. Such a funny, like, still feels really sort of difficult to process that film. The documentary aesthetic, the sort of sci-fi genre, the political content, the conflicts, which are sort of hard to parse. Yeah. Great movie. Good reco.
Thank you.
And I'm writing it down because I have actually not seen it. So great. I look forward to watching that. Okay, and that's a wrap on The Power of the Dog and our first podcast of 2022. Thanks for being here with us today, Goresh. It was so great to have a person I've never met before, but who I was wonderfully charmed by right from the moment you started talking.
Goresh, thank you so much.
This was fun. Thank you so much.
No, it was wonderful to talk with you and meet you. Yeah. I've always known really, really well the guests to have on, so it was such a cool experience to talk with someone for the first time and record it. Tell us, where can our listeners find you and some of your writing online?
I have a blog, and if you just type my name in, Goresh Shambu, the first thing that comes up on Google will be my website and my blog. And I'm also on Twitter, Goresh Shambu at Twitter. Thank you.
Great. And what was the name of your book? I know it's been a few years, but it's such a fascinating book. I'd like you to plug that for us.
It's called The New Cinephilia. It's about internet film culture. And there's a new edition that came out that's on PDF only a year ago.
Ooh, nice.
So it's available in both those forms. You can find it at Amazon and other places. Thank you.
Fantastic.
Amazing. To read this month's Best of 2021 issue, which includes essays on Licorice Pizza, Undine, The Souvenir Part 2, and more, you can visit us at brightwalldarkroom.com or sign up for our weekly newsletter where we tell you what we did that week with links. It's really straightforward. You can also find us on Twitter at BWDR.
And if you haven't already, please do be sure to subscribe to the podcast, share the show with a friend, tell someone that you know about it, or consider leaving us a positive rating or review. That helps us reach more movie lovers like you.
We're at 4.6, so it would be great if we could bump up after this episode. And in addition to helping our numbers, the best way to support the podcast is to visit patreon.com/brightwalldarkroom. Our theme music is composed by Chad Perman. This podcast is produced and edited by Eli Sands.
Bye.
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 't think we ever actually talked about the actual plot.
It's on Netflix. People can watch it if they want to.